Today, Johnny Lawrence will speak on his translation of Crooked Plough, which is longlisted for the International Booker Prize 2024. Crooked Plough was originally written in Portuguese by Itamar Vieira Jr. Johnny Lawrence, son of Brazilian immigrants to the United States, is a translator of Brazilian literature, poet, and literary critic. He holds a doctorate in English from the University of Texas at Austin and is a professor at Montclair State University. His translation of the novel Crooked Plough received support from the National Endowment for Arts. His translation of Clarice Lispector's A Breath of Life was a finalist for the Best Translated Book Award, and his translation of Lispector's The Besieged City was listed as one of the best books of 2019 by Vanity Fair. His forthcoming translation of The Front by Ejimilson G. Almeida Pereira received a Sundial Literary Translation Award. He has received a Penheim Translation Fund grant and a Fulbright to support his work. His scholarly articles on writers such as Machado de Assis, Uwem Fonseca, and Clarice Lispector have appeared in Luso-Brazilian Review, Latin American Literary Review, and Modern Fiction Studies. You can buy the book Crooked Plough using the link given in the show notes, and you can give us the feedback on this particular episode via Spotify app. Welcome to Harshniyam Podcast Journey. Such a pleasure to have you here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
When and how did you develop interest in literature to begin with?
So I grew up in Miami Beach in the United States, an absurd place to grow up. A ridiculous place to grow up. My parents are Brazilian immigrants, and I went to Catholic school as a child. So I would say that there's a lot of shall we say there are magical stories that were taught to me as part of my education. But it really wasn't until I went to public high school and I had a literature teacher who was very cruel and very almost fascist in the classroom, but it changed my life. I should be more careful with that word these days. I should say that he was he was unforgiving. But that course changed my life, I think, because he introduced us to literature that I think was very ambitious. The kinds of things I read in that class in high school, where we were treated as adults, you know, we were treated as young adults reading Shakespeare and T.S. Eliot and absurdist theater and existential modernist novels, and you know, you just had no choice but to kind of raise your level to match what the teacher expected. And I think that opened up this world that to me almost seemed like a secret world of literature, and I think that's when things probably began to change for me.
So when did you decide to make pursuing literature as a career option?
As a profession, well, I think my parents were hoping that I would go into something like ophthalmology. My family isn't a particularly, shall we say, it's not a family that's particularly interested in literature. So it must have seemed almost like an extraterrestrial was speaking to them about what I wanted to pursue in my studies. Okay. Why would you spend all of this time and effort to have an English degree to study literature? It makes no sense. That's I think what they, and I understand. But I think that when I went to college and I was still interested in this new world that opened up to me in high school, especially when I took some creative writing classes, then I think I really wanted to somehow make this part of my future and perhaps part of my career. I went to pursue a PhD in literature at the University of Texas at Austin. And I think, you know, in some ways I have to admit I couldn't think of anything better than staying in the classroom. I wonder if in some sense that was it was a lack. I like to think it was some imaginative faculty on my part, some imaginative power that I had that brought me into the literature and translation, but it might have been the lack of imagination. I couldn't think of anything that would take me away from the classroom. And so I wanted to stay in a classroom arguing about an interpretation of a literary text. And that was so exciting to me that maybe that's why I turned it into a career. I should say, in terms of translation, I would go back to Brazil with my mother to visit family in Brazil. And my grandmother, who was back in Brazil, she was a school teacher. And she, I think, maybe it skipped a generation. She liked to read, and she liked, you know, she liked to share things with me. So she gave me my first book in Portuguese, and it was the poems of a poet named Mario Quintana, who is a very popular poet in Brazil. One of those poets that everybody has heard of and everybody remembers some poem of his. And I realized that there was nothing in English by this poet. Nothing had been translated. And so I think in some sense, I just decided, well, there you go, right? I mean, if I'm going to read his poetry in English, I'm going to have to translate it, and then I'll be able to read it in English. And somehow the Fulbright committee agreed. So I was given a Fulbright in 2003, when I was just out of graduate school, just starting as an assistant professor. And I was able to live for 6 months in Brazil and translate. And I think that was really the real step towards literary translation.
How did Clarice Lispector happen?
Well, this is one of those stories that I think there might be a moral to it that might be useful to folks. And the moral is that sometimes you think of something as a failure, and it turns out to actually be very fruitful. And I think that's sort of what happened in this little anecdote that I'm about to share. I really wanted to translate a particular novel that I had read, and I had shared a sample of my translation with an editor of a publishing house. And she had said, no, it's, you know, it's interesting, but it's not quite right for our press. The kind of thing that we've heard before in our in our profession. It's wonderful, but it's not quite right. And eventually, actually, another translator had the good fortune of convincing someone to publish the book. So I missed out on being able to translate it and publish it. So I was disappointed. But what happened in that situation was that editor remembered me. And even though she didn't sign on to the project, she remembered my translation, and she remembered, what she thought I was capable of doing. And so when Benjamin Moser, the series editor for New Directions, the Clarice Lispector series editor, when he was looking for a translator, he asked this particular editor if she knew anyone. And she mentioned me, and she said, you know, we didn't pick up this project that he was, you know, trying to generate some enthusiasm for, but I think that he would be right for this Lispector series. And so that opened this path for me. And looking back, you know, I think in the moment I thought I experienced failure. And I think time teaches us this, right? Wisdom teaches you this, that sometimes you don't realize that failure leads to success. So,
Itamar Vieira Jr., he's a first-time novelist, but I believe he has written some short stories earlier.
Yes.
Interestingly, he's an ethnographer too. Tell us about him in detail, please.
Well, Itamar, he did something pretty sensational. You know, he has his second novel published in Brazil. So I'm working on translating that novel. So hopefully it'll come out in English in the near future. But this book that we're talking about right now, Crooked Plow, which is called Torto Arado in Portuguese, he sent it to a competition in Portugal. So he sent it from Brazil to Portugal. And it's supposed to be for, you know, you send in your manuscript and it's the Leia Prize. It's very prestigious. There's a nice financial prize to it. And it also means publication. And he even said to me once, which is sort of amazing to think about, he went to the post office because this was still one of those competitions where you had to send in the paper, you know, the actual physical manuscript, not a digital version. And he looked at the price for sending, you know, maybe 200 pages in paper across the Atlantic. And it was, you know, and in Brazil, the currency is not that strong compared to the euro. And for a second, he thought to himself, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't send it. Can you imagine? In another reality, he just walked back home and said, the postage is too expensive and none of this would have happened. And instead, he sends it. It wins the prize. It gets published in Portugal. It gets published in Brazil. It wins Best Novel of the Year, the Jabuti Prize in Brazil. It wins the Oceanus Prize for the best international work of literature in the Portuguese language. Now it's long listed. The English translation that we worked on together is long listed for the Booker. And just to think that in another reality, he would have said the mail postage, right? The postage is too expensive. It's incredible to think about these sort of moments in destiny, right? And, but he's educated as an ethnographer. He works for or has worked for a federal agency that's interested in land reform. And this field work that he did, where he was basically living with, if I can use the word, peasants, you know, with rural communities of very impoverished but very proud, hardworking, sometimes we would say marginalized communities in Brazil. This time studying their relationship to the land, their social relationships with each other and with structures of power, all of this became information that he would use to create this beautiful novel.
Johnny, you're a literary critic too. What was your reaction when you read this novel for the first time in Portuguese, of course?
I have to admit that I read it on my phone. I usually give my students, because I teach, and I usually give my students a hard time about reading on their phones, you know, because I'm like one of those, I turn into one of those stuffy old professors who, I must sound to them like someone from 300 years ago, you know. I'm like, oh, sometimes you just need to have a book in your hands, you know, you need to smell the book and touch the book. So the book was published in Portugal. It had not yet been published in Brazil. And I had read it because I was able to download it, the digital version on my phone, before it was even published. You know, I wish I remember how I knew about it. I think that someone online must have said, oh, this is an interesting book that just came out in Portugal and is soon to be published in Brazil. And somehow, I think I was just looking for something to read. I downloaded it, I read it, and I immediately said to myself, I want to translate this book. And I right away, I sought out Itamar Vieira Jr. I got in touch with him. I said, look, I'm blown away by this book. I want to translate it. I started working on it. I sent a sample to the National Endowment for the Arts, which gives a nice grant to translation projects. And as fate would have it, again, I'm sorry I'm invoking fate and destiny so much. I usually don't do this sort of thing, but I received the grant from the National Endowment for the Arts the same week that Itamar received Best Novel of the Year. So it seemed, you know, it might not be destiny, but it sort of felt like destiny. It looked like destiny.
The novel is, like a historical fiction to me. Early 20th century is the setting, right?
You're touching on a tricky question in the book. In some sense, I kind of don't want to be too specific, but because you're inviting me to talk about the question of the period, I would say the second half of the 20th century. That's what I would say. I mean, there are some things that because there are so many flashbacks and so many sort of memories of the old timers that show up, grandparents and whatnot, we go back to the early 20th century. We go back to a period just after abolition of slavery in the late 19th century. But the two women, the two sisters at the heart of the novel, are products of the middle of the 20th century going into, I think, going all the way into the 1980s, I would say. That's one of the reasons why some readers are a little unsure about when the novel takes place. So if you were a little confused, I think that's intentional. I think the book wants to be a little bit ambiguous about when we are. So that's why your question is a question that often comes up when Itamar is giving a talk, that people want to know, wait, when is this actually taking place? Because part of the argument of the novel is that it doesn't, for these farmers, it feels a lot like the 19th century. And it doesn't feel like, I think for some of us, we can read this and it would seem like historical fiction, as you mentioned, right? It feels like, for the most part, I'll give you an example, right? And I'm sure you can speak to this as well. There are some places in the world where in town, people have running water. But in the fields or outside of town, women, usually the women who have to tend the garden, let's say, and feed the children, have to go to the river or to a well,
yes,
and bring the water back home. So it's almost like you have simultaneous times coexisting in the same time. So once in a while, a car shows. So if you're reading the novel, you'll notice once in a while, a car shows up. It's almost sort of like, well, that's like the one car that they see. And the one time that they go to the hospital, I won't say too much about the story, but the girls are wounded. And so they're driven to the hospital. It's the first time that they've seen anything outside of their community. So, asphalt roads and buildings and, a hospital, all of this, it's like going to another planet for them.
Now, can you please introduce the novel to our listeners?
The novel is a story told from the point of view of two sisters who have experienced a terrible wounding, both of them, in a very literal way, but also in a psychological way, a terrible wounding. And the thing is that because of this terrible accident, it brings them closer together because one of them becomes the voice of the other, right? So in the first section, the narration is from the point of view of one sister, Bibiana. The second section of the book is from the point of view of the other sister, Belonisia. And the third section is from the point of view of, I'm not going to tell you.
Yeah.
Because it's a secret. But let me just say that when that third voice enters the novel, the novel shifts in a very powerful and beautiful way. And that's one thing I don't want to say maybe too much about, because I think that that discovering that voice is one of the pleasures of the novel.
What is very telling for me is when one girl loses her voice, the other girl, you know, gives her the voice. The one who loses her voice, she remains in the village with all that oppression and whatnot, you know, patriarchy and all that. And the one who goes to the town, who has a voice, she comes back and literally she starts giving voice to the whole community. That is very, very beautifully portrayed in the novel.
That's right. And I think that in some ways we can see this tension between the sister who goes to get educated, yes, and the sister who stays behind to keep farming the land and to do the household chores. And in some sense, the sister who goes off into the world, she gets educated, she becomes part of the labor movement, she's fighting for social justice. The other sister, it would be easy to say that she's the one who's not the feminist, who is not, shall we say, progressive. But the book doesn't allow us to be dismissive of her. In many ways, we might even say that she is the stronger of the two.
Yeah, she stays there and she keeps fighting. Yeah.
Yeah, but in a different way, right? In a different way. And the men of the community almost can't believe that she is able to farm the way that she does, because she is physically very strong and more capable than many of the men in her community. So and she learns to listen to the earth. She learns what her father teaches her about the herbs and about, you know, about pests in the field. And it's sort of like that's her classroom. Her classroom was the field.
See, basically this novel details a particular indigenous community's lives, rituals and beliefs. They belong to a particular place, right? That is in northwest, I believe, northwest of Brazil.
Northeast.
Bahia.
Northeast, yes.
Northeast of Brazil. Bahia, right? The Bahia, state of Bahia. Right, Bahia. So what is the experience of translating like? Did you prepare for anything, or what exactly? Did you have any interaction with the author? Tell us about the experience of translating it.
I suppose there is something a little bit tricky about translating descriptions, representations of sacred rituals, and perhaps rituals that are not necessarily part of your own personal belief system. I should say that because I've been to Salvador in Bahia, which is not exactly where the book is set, but I have been to the kind of ritual that we see depicted in the novel. The novel is interested in this community that we call Jare. And so Jare is a sort of a belief system, let's say, that is informed by the African diaspora as well as indigenous communities. And I've witnessed something called candomblé, which is, you know, they're linked in very powerful ways. You will hear the drumming, and particular rhythms are ways of calling down divinities. I've seen people possessed by divinity, and that happens in Jare as well. But there are some differences. And so one of the things that I felt like I needed to do to make sure that I could translate in a way that was most accurate is, one is I was able to speak with the author, Itamar, about questions I had. But generally the questions weren't so much about Jare. I will say though that I did just do some reading about Jare that I felt was very illuminating. I'm not sure how much it really affected my translation per se, but it made me feel more confident about understanding what was happening around the page in a way, or around the language. So there's a book, for example, by Gabriel Banagia called As Forças do Jare, sort of like the powers of Jare. And And some of the scenes in the book, the descriptions are very similar to this kind of ethnographic description that I was reading about in terms of the healer, in terms of the rhythms, the processions that took place. And so I'd say that that was something that I had to pay, you know, particular attention to make sure that I got some of those details right. Another thing that I think is going to be perhaps less sort of spectacular, because talking about translation, people think, oh, how do you translate, you know, the divinities coming down and taking possession of people and this sort of musical event? Or how do you translate, you know, these abstract concepts that you find in the Portuguese language? But in all honesty, I think a lot of the difficulty is the tissue of a language, that it's the little words that people don't really pay attention to, that you find, in English, the preposition works this way, or the pronoun works this way. But in Portuguese, there's some ambiguity. And now in English, I have to be more precise, but I could be precise in the wrong direction. So I'll give you a quick example of this. A pronoun, for example, in English will reveal the gender of the person, whereas in Portuguese, the pronoun refers to the gender of the object, not the gender of the person to whom the object belongs. So if I say his car, that's very specific about whose car it belongs to versus her car or their car. But in Portuguese, if I say seu carro, you don't know if it's a man or a woman who owns that car. It's ambiguous. And that might not seem like a big deal, but for a translator, it can cause headaches, because there are certain scenes where the language is very ambiguous. In Portuguese, the word in and the word on are the same word. So that can also be ambiguous. If you are in something or on something, it can be an important distinction. But in Portuguese, if they feel like it's important, then there'll be some more language around it. But sometimes it's left kind of ambiguous, and you have to wrestle with that. And so no one wants to talk about that in a way, because it seems sort of, I don't know, technical, right? Pronoun usage. But for the translator, that's the stuff that can cause headaches.
Right. And I believe sometimes authors want to create ambiguity. I wonder how translators get that.
Yes. Well, you know, I think it's important to be, I think, well, people are going to have different feelings about this, but I would say that you have to show restraint as a translator, because sometimes your first instinct is to interpret the text, and you're reading it and you're interpreting it. But when you're asked to translate something, you have to show restraint, because you don't want to color your translation with your sense of what's going on between the lines, and then you're revealing too much, and then you deny the reader the chance to have one's own interpretation.
Now, before I ask you to read the excerpt from the novel, Johnny, you're a poet, literary critic, translator, teacher, too many roles. How does one role influence the other?
Well, I would say that one of the things that I think poetry has taught me, and that's this relates to the discussion we just had about ambiguity, is that poets are very interested in what is not said. And I think that has helped me as a translator. Because you have to, in some sense, translate the silence and be respectful of the silence. And sometimes that means not filling in the silence, holding back on that urge to fill the silence when the text wants that silence to be present. I think sometimes my literary critic tendency is something that, for example, when I read this book for the first time, part of me, you know, obviously, like I'm thinking as a critic as well, I'm responding powerfully, both as a literary critic and just as someone who's reading for curiosity or out of some sort of sense of pleasure or intellectual interest. But sometimes the literary critic, sometimes those glasses can get me into trouble reading with those eyes, because I'm already, you know, I'm already like thinking about arguments that I want to make about the book. But I have to sort of, in a way, like I can't pretend that I don't have that side of me, but I have to be mindful of the fact that that's a different kind of work, right? But I would still say that all of those hats that I wear allow me to keep shifting gears in a sense, and that is actually it makes my work so much more fun, you know, especially the teaching part. You know, you're always thinking about your audience when you're a teacher. You're always thinking about what they hear. That makes me think about literature as not just this sort of quiet, lonely practice of reading, but teaching always reminds you that there are listeners, and especially it's very, you know, it can be very, how do I say this? The reading experience can be very visual, but the teaching experience, I'm really in a space where I'm filling the room with sound and I'm listening to the questions of my students. And that reminds you something about the ear and about the sounds of your words, the musicality of speech.
Interestingly, the other novel, which is long listed, The Silver Bone, translated by Boris Dralyuk. In your novel, this Crooked Plow, one of the main characters, she loses her tongue, right? In that, the protagonist loses his ear.
Ah, I'm going to have to read this novel now.
You should. It reads like a detective novel, actually, detective fiction. But it's actually talking about a common man's life in early 20th century in Ukraine, in Kyiv, to be specific.
And I think as a novel, I think it's very interesting when that situation happens. It makes you think a little bit more about something that, like, let's say, for example, one of the characters loses her tongue. And so it makes you think more about the act of giving voice or the act of speech. And I don't know, you know, where you might be in a particular novel, or if you remember this scene from Crooked Plow, but there's a very difficult and beautiful scene where one of the characters is trying to speak with a tongue that just won't do what she wants it to do. And the way that sort of makes you think about communicating, about speaking not only with words, but she finds a way to speak with her body. She finds a way to speak with her facial expressions. It makes something that for a lot of us can be kind of invisible suddenly become more front of mind.
One of my friends, when I mentioned about this novel to him, he was saying even in Greek mythology, there is a very similar incident where one of the angels or Greek gods loses a tongue. I don't know whether there is a parallel or...
Oh, sure. Yeah, there's... I won't get into it too much, but there's a very famous cutting of the tongue that happens with a figure named Philomela.
Philomela.
Yes, yeah, you're thinking right, of. Philomela. Yes, yes. And she finds a way to speak through her art. She tells us, this is beautiful, she tells a story through tapestry. Well, in some ways, I like to think that, you know, one of the key images in the book is a knife. And in some way, and so, you know, again, I don't want to say too much, but in some way, one of the characters learns to speak with a knife.
Knife, in the sense, I understood it in a way that it's kind of giving power back to the indigenous community. When they get it back, right? They lose it and they get it back. Anyway, no spoilers. Anyway, I'll cut this out.
No, it's the knife keeps appearing and disappearing in the book. So,
before we end the conversation, please read an excerpt from the novel, Johnny.
I'm going to read an excerpt that I've not read before. So I'd like to just give maybe just a bit of context. One of the sisters is explaining that her grandmother is beginning to speak strangely. and she's not sure what's going on, but her grandmother, her name is Donana, Grandma Donana, she begins to call the girls, her grandchildren, by the wrong name. She begins to say, I'm going to look for your father. And she's like, but my father's right here. And she's kind of lost in time, and we suspect that maybe she's suffering delirium. So that's the bit of context I'd like to give. My mother asked us to go with our grandmother to keep an eye on her so she wouldn't get hurt or lost in the woods. Don't let your grandmother step into the stream. Watch out for snakes, and don't laugh at your grandmother. We'd walk beside her, and then, as it was already December, we'd stop here and there to collect ripe fruit. We'd end up forgetting about Grandma. Sometimes we'd lose sight of her completely. But then we'd keep quiet, and soon her voice would ring out from the middle of the woods, calling for Carmelita and her other kids to help find Zeca. And we'd run to meet her. When my father returned home from the fields, and we tried to explain to Grandma that Zeca, her son, was standing right there in front of her, she always said it wasn't him, and that the only thing she wanted from that man was his hat. One afternoon in February, while we were nodding off in the summer heat, Grandma slipped out. When my mother, farming a plot of land closer to the house, came back home to drink some water, she noticed that her mother-in-law wasn't there. She told me to find her. I wanted Belonesia to go with me, but I didn't know where she was. I went down the path Grandma usually took with her other kids when searching for my father. Along the way, there stood a large budichi palm, and the ground was covered with fallen fruit. Before resuming my search for Grandma, who should have arrived by then at her usual spot, I gathered all the fruit I could carry by lifting the skirt of my dress and improvising a basket. The copper-colored globes had thick, scaly skin. You would never guess at the succulent flesh whose juices stained the bodies of the women carrying the fresh pulp to sell in town. The money it brought in allowed us to buy necessities when our crops were destroyed by drought or floods. Carrying the budichi fruit in the fold of my skirt, I arrived at the shallow part of the Uchinga River, where it fed into a marsh near the path to the fields. And there, in the shallows, I found Grandma, floating face down like an animal. Her white hair, like a luminous loofah sponge, reflected the sunlight in the clear water. I recognized her faded dress. It was so old, it might have been the same dress Grandma was wearing when she first arrived at our house in the back of a truck, my father at her side, just before I was born. Terrified by the vision before me, likely the first time I'd seen death up close, I let all the fruit fall and roll into the shadows. I shook my grandmother, might she wake up, and turned her small, frail body over, then tried to pull her out of the water, but I wasn't able. I ran home for help, suffocated by what I'd seen. Along the way, I found Belonesia, my sister, crouching by the same budichi tree where I had stopped just minutes before. She was gathering the fruit I'd been unable to carry with me to the river. She looked up and saw the terror on my face. One of us would tell the others what had happened.
Yeah, nice. Very nice. Thank you for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much. And thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.